We're doing Pirkei Avot with the Jewish home. We'll continue with the first chapter, fourth Mishnah. Yosef ben Yehezri, Shlidav, Yosef ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim. We have two leaders, both named Yossi. One is the leader of the city of Tzreda. The other one is the important man of Jerusalem. Kiblu Mehem, they accepted the oral tradition from Antigone, Antignos, and Shimon HaTzadik. And now we're beginning the period in Jewish history called the Zugot, the pairs, where you had one of the pair was the Nasi, and one of the pair was the Av Betin. And ordinarily we assume the first one mentioned in the Mishnah is the Nasi, and the second one is the Av Betin, but that's not always the case. Sometimes you have instances where in the Jerusalem Talmud, there was a machlokes, which one was the Nasi and which one was the Av Betin, as we'll see Bezrat Hashem in Mishnah Vav. Yossi ben Yehezri Shtzreda Omer. So Yossi ben Yehezri says, Yehi Veitcha Beit Vad L'Chachamim. Your house should be the place where the sages know they can gather, where they want to gather, where it's a fit place for people to gather. So very often you gather in a Bet Knesset, in a Bet Midrash, but if you have a home where you know Talmidei Chachamim are welcome, so then your home can be the Beit Vad L'Chachamim. I haven't seen many people, but I've seen some people who fulfill this Mishnah. There are people who ensure when they build their house that there's a place there where learned people can come learn. We have someone in Kochav Yaakov who took a large section of their house and made it into a Bet Midrash that's open 24 hours a day, so people can come learn there. So he made his house, a Beit Vad L'Chachamim. Anytime people are looking for a place where they could learn and talk Torah, they know in his house. There's a whole section there. It's open 24 hours a day. It's partitioned from his house. You could come learn Torah there. You could get a hot drink there. Beit Vad L'Chachamim. This can also be fulfilled when sometimes you live out of town. Sometimes people are coming to visit, and they should know that your house is the house where Talmidei Chachamim are welcome. So the Mishnah continues and says, you should serve them, so to speak. Find yourself clinging to the dust of their feet. So this is part of the chinuch we give our kids. It's part of the chinuch we give ourselves. Years ago, I was invited by an important rav who lives in this neighborhood. Actually, I invited myself over to his house. He didn't invite me. I kept saying I want to come. And I was learning in yeshiva all alone here. And at one point, he couldn't say no. So he put out a lot of svarim. He's a big talmid chacham. And at the time, all his kids were still single at home. Now, just so you see the picture, as I was leaving the house, they moved the dining room table away, and they started putting down mattresses, 12 mattresses side by side in the living room. All his kids, it couldn't have been 12, he had 9 kids, so 9 mattresses. 9 mattresses side by side, all the kids are sleeping in the living room. They had, I think, 2 rooms in the house. And when we sat down for the meal, so you couldn't get up, meaning we fit around the table, and that was it. You fit around the table. If you wanted to get out, everyone had to shift so you could get out from your place on the table. And when I told him, I said, I'd like to see your Shabbos table. I want to learn from it. So he agreed, but he said, just bear in mind that you're not a quarter chicken. So I didn't understand, what does he mean you're not a quarter chicken? So then he explained it to me. Usually when you have a guest, every person gets a quarter chicken, right? You figure out how much you're buying for each person who's coming to the table. He said, in our house, we can't afford chicken. My kids don't eat chicken on Shabbos, and I don't eat chicken on Shabbos, but my wife makes special kugel for Shabbos. So don't expect chicken. You're not getting meat because we can't afford meat for ourselves. I said, fine, I'm not coming for the food. I came to their house expecting, whatever. I wanted to see how a Talmud Chacham runs his Shabbos table. And I brought flowers. It's a good American boy, right? I brought flowers before Shabbos. The first thing that happened was all the kids were all excited over flowers at the Shabbos table. And the next thing that happened was that throughout the meal, every child, when they brought food to the table, so they brought it to me as though I was a prince, like ha'orech rotze. And the treatment that the father gave me, here I am this young, I must be in first year base medrash. So what was I, 18, 17? He's an old man with a white beard, but he and his children all gave such treatment, like I was the most important person who ever came to their house. And the way they spoke about it, ha'orech, about the guest is coming, it was like, I felt like who knows what. And I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized that was his chinuch. So the children always liked having guests. He taught them how cherished it was that they had a guest. And everything they'd offer me, I didn't want to eat anything. You know, when you realize the family can't afford chicken, you don't want to eat their salad. You don't want to eat anything. You know, but the way they treated me, I never got such treatment in my life. Where the whole house was so excited over you. The way we treat people, that teaches us something. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu used to tell stories about how his father used to treat rabbis that came to the house. He would stand there and serve them the tea like a servant. And the treatment that he gave taught the children to value a Talmid Chacham. The Mishnah says, hug, cling to the dust on their feet. It's an approach. And the attitude I have to the Chacham that comes to my house is what I'm teaching my children. And drink their words with thirst. How often do we hear there's a shiur going on and we say, I learned that already. Or I didn't learn too much from the shiur tonight. How much do we remember? We once had a student here. I wish him well. He should come back swiftly. Who lent me a book. And then he moved to Chutz La'aretz. And then he emailed me and said, you could keep the book. That was one of the worst emails I ever got. Because that was like, I'm not coming back to get it. You know? So he lent me this book on our memory. There's a book called The Jewish Mind. The Secret of the Jewish Mind. Sod HaMoach HaYehudi. The Secret of the Jewish Mind. And this book researches how the rabbis were able to learn so much by heart. Mishnah, Gemara, how did they do it? And one of the things he says is that we have tremendous capacity to remember, and we decide that we don't. And so we limit our memory. He says, all of us have things that we decide, I can't remember that, and so we don't. And if we decide that we could, we would. So I heard this, and I said, nah. And the guy who said it to me said, yeah. So I said, okay, I'll try it. I'm gonna believe that I could remember numbers. I know I can't. But I'll take his word for it that I can, and I'll try. You know what? Ever since then, I could remember telephone numbers. I never used to be able to remember numbers. You tell me 9 digits now, 10 digits now, I could remember it. It's a phenomenal thing. When we decide that we could, suddenly we open up our memory banks. We're capable of tremendous things that we think we cannot do. And each of us has areas where we decide, I can't remember that, and then we can't. We shut down. And if we open up, we can. So that's point number one. The second thing he says is, if you really care about something, then you engrave it in your mind and you do remember it. We had a class here this past Thursday night, and the Rav said that he could remember lines from movies he saw 25, 30 years ago. It's there. How come? Because we were totally engrossed in what was going on. You watch a certain movie, and the line is there. And it's not because you saw it 15 times, even if there are movies you saw once, but the line stays with you. Back to Torah. If you walk into a shir and you're thirsting for what it says, then you absorb it differently. I tried something when I was learning. I tried testing myself. If I could read a page of Gemara and come back, read Rashi, and then read the page of Gemara a second time and fill in what Rashi said without looking in Rashi. So the first few days I tried, I failed miserably. But after a few days, I started reading the Gemara differently. I started reading the Gemara, telling myself, okay, when I'm going to finish, I'm going to test myself. Can I read that without looking at Rashi? And suddenly I started remembering differently. It wasn't as good as I would have liked because I was developing short-term memory as opposed to long-term memory. We still have to shift. You still have to make that shift and stick it into the long-term memory bank. But at least I was developing short-term. I don't know what's about you, but most of my life, I would learn something, pick up my head, and now ask me what I was learning. I don't even remember the tractate. The pasuk says, "Hataif einecha bo," the blink of an eye, "veinenu," and everything you learned is gone. My father would ask me at the end of the day, "What did you learn today?" And I'd look at him and go, "Huh?" My father would say, "What subjects did you learn today? Don't tell me who held what. Tell me what was the topic you learned today." And I'd look at him and say, "I have no clue. I have no idea. How are you doing on your tests? I'm getting hundreds. But then how come you don't remember? I have no clue." Because I didn't live it. If you're living the text, if you're there, if you care to remember, you'll remember. Do we care to remember? So, Eveshotev Atzamat Divrayim is a formula for all of Torah. Am I thirsting to hear what they have to say? The Mishnah is teaching us an attitude. If I'm thirsting and it's something I can develop within myself. One of the gifts parents can give their children is if they tell them, "Son, you're not staying in yeshiva." And the kid has to fight for it. And then the parent says, "Okay, you can go for a few months and then we'll talk about it again." Then the yeshiva isn't a given. When you have to fight for it and it's not a given, then suddenly every day is treasured. Every page of Gemara is treasured. Let me take advantage of my time. When yeshiva is a given, everyone's going, "For sure you can go." So then, how much do you take advantage? How cherished is it? How much are you yearning to take in the words of the Torah? And our attitude makes all the difference. It defines how much we accept, how much we absorb. And this has been proven by secular research. Even if all of you would know that at the end of this class you're going to have a test, a questionnaire, what did we do today, you would retain differently. You know, at the end of my speeches, sometimes I ask, "What did we learn today?" And there's silence in the shul. And I say, "I know I wasn't here alone. You were all with me here. What did we learn today?" I like to summarize at the end of a speech, "What did we learn today?" Now, some people realize I'm going to ask that at the end because I've been asking that for 3 years now. So they pay attention and people start firing back. "You said this, you said that, you said this, you said that," because they care to retain. So ask yourself when you start learning, "Let me challenge myself in 20 minutes. Will I know what I just did? Can I remember?" Now we're going to shift to married life. How does this apply in a marriage? We'll get there in a second. Yes, Amir.
Sure.
I don't think that it means you should be all antsy every day that the floor has to be clean because I might have a Talmid Chacham coming. I think it means the vibes that come out of your house, that Talmidei Chachamim know that they're welcome there, that whenever they need a place to meet, they're welcome there. Behind this building on Shoshana Street, 40 years ago, so I can tell you a few stories, but I'll tell you just one. There was a man who passed away last week, Rabbi Levinger. Okay, so he was a big force behind the development of the Itnachluyot. Well, you know, when the rabbis needed to decide whether they would start building Jewish homes in many of the territories, there was a few rabbis who had to think about it and decide, are they making the moves? There was a young man who learned in Yeshivat Merkaz Arav with them. And he told them, "My house is available." And his children grew up on the laps of the rabbis who led the building of those communities. And his children pulled their beards. And Rav Drukman and Rav Waldman were known as Rav Buban and Rav Baban. They had all these wonderful names by the little kids who didn't know them. But The rabbis knew that they were welcome in that home. They needed a home where they could think and where they could plan and they could start a movement, and they did. And today you see Beit El, and you see Alon Shvut, and you see all these huge tens of thousands of people who are living throughout the land of Israel. It started in that home. It was the home of a Jew just behind the yeshiva who made it available to them. A person doesn't always have to be the greatest leader. He has to give that vibe. You're welcome in my home. You want it, you'll have it. And the way I've seen it works in life is that if you want the mitzvah, you'll find the way to do it. If you want your home to be a home where Talmidei Chachamim are present, they'll be in your home. If it's important to you, if you really want it, it'll happen. I've seen it over and over again. When it's important to you, then you find the venue to make it a reality. Yes?
You also spend Shabbat, you're supposed to invite somebody that you don't benefit from the Chacham you benefit from.
Okay. I don't know where it says you should invite someone you don't benefit from. It's a nice, kind thing to do. There are many kind things to do.
But I learned that like, it's very easy to invite people that you find interesting, or fun, and so on and so on and so on. It's more difficult to invite somebody that you don't benefit at all just by inviting them.
That's also true. That's also true. Let me tell you a story. About 7-8 years ago, we were davening in Mosad Rav Kook, and I saw an old man sitting in davening, and I see him all alone. So at the end of davening, I ask him, where are you eating the meal today? He said, I'm going to go home and eat the meal. And I see he's all alone. So I sent my son home, and I told him, go tell your mother that we have another person for the meal. And then I invited him to come eat by us. I had agreed with my wife years ago that if I see someone who I think needs a meal, that my wife said, it's okay, I can invite him, and we'll manage. It's okay. I invited him over. The man comes to our house and he joins the meal. And as we're talking through the meal, it turns out he personally met the Chafetz Chaim. And the stories he told me, I am forever enriched by that Shabbos meal with this old man. So I wasn't looking for any benefit. I just saw an old man who seemed to be all alone in shul. And I didn't see him with any grandchildren. And at the end of davening, when I asked him where he was going to eat, it sounded like he was going home alone, that his wife was no longer with him. She had passed away and he was going to spend the meal alone. So I invited him to come to my house. And I could tell you, all of us were enriched. My children and I'm not saying every story has such a nice ending. It's not the only time I invited someone, and that's not the only ending, but sometimes you also get enriched. Okay, but back to the Jewish home. So the first thing, Daniel correctly pointed out that there are many aspects of mitzvot that you can perform in a home. You can't choose alone. You have to see what's right for your wife. Your wife might say, we need the time to invest in our own relationship. We need the time to invest in our children. And that's legitimate. You see that Abraham wanted to bring Yishmael into the tent. And Sarah said, Adkan, you're destroying the tent. He doesn't belong here. And that's a calculation you have to think about too. Sometimes people are so invested in helping other people, their own children are losing by it. So you have to know the application of the Mishnah within the home, it's a partnership. There has to be an agreement. With that, you also have to know how to maintain modesty. Meaning if you're taking in a rabbi, so then your job is to be the host. There's a modesty that has to be between the woman of the house and the male guest, and it doesn't matter if he's a rabbi. The Talmud tells us that Rabbi Meir had a house that would always take him in when he was en route to be Ole, to go up to Jerusalem. And the man got remarried. His first wife passed away, he got remarried. And his second wife was an improper woman. And so when he left the house, she put something in Rabbi Meir's drink, knocked him out, and then did all kinds of foolish things with him. And when he woke up, she started joking with him. And he said, why are you talking to me that way? She was very frivolous with him. And she said, what do you mean? You don't remember what you and I did? And he said, no, I have no idea. What are you talking about? And then she started telling him, you have a mole over there and you have a birthmark over there. And Rabbi Meir went out of his mind. He ran out of the house. He said, what happened? How could this be? And he ran to the rabbis and he said, what am I supposed to do? I don't remember any of this. And she's saying all of this happened, but she knows about my birthmarks and everything. And how could she know that if? And the rabbi said, she must have played a trick on you. And they went and they checked it out. And she knocked him out. And then she undressed him. And then she was able to tell him and make up a whole story about everything that happened. But our sages warn us that when the Mishnah says, your house should be a welcome place for the sages, that doesn't mean you should transgress the importance of modesty. You know, we have a policy in our house that if women want to come with a question, they either come with their husband or they stand outside the door. And if it's a personal question, so it's in public domain, and if they don't want to speak in, or it's in the room with my wife. One of three things, either come with your husband or my wife has to be in the room, or I'll talk to you outside in public domain. But because women come like often, so we have to maintain some kind of a system which is modest. If a woman wants to meet in a coffee shop, okay, we can meet in a public domain which is not outside in the sun. But there has to be some kind of system. The same thing, if I'm going to make my house available, so I have to ensure that my house is modest. The idea of being interested in what someone else is saying is especially challenging with our wives. Hashem created us that our modes of speech are very different. And so when a conversation begins, usually the man is looking for the point. What do you want to tell me? And within the first 3 to 5 seconds, he expects you'll tell him what you want to tell him. Whereas when a woman comes to the conversation, she could speak for 20 minutes before she gets to the point. You know, I really wanted to tell you that the other day as I was walking down the street and there was such a breeze and I didn't dress the kids warmly enough, and I was wondering, why is it that every time they tell us the forecast, it's so inaccurate? Sometimes they get it right, and just when you listen to them, then they get it wrong. And here I didn't have the kids ready, and one of the kids walked in the puddle, and he got his socks all wet, and we were so far away from the house. And, you know, I tell them not to, but they don't listen. And maybe we have to be more concerned about the kids listening when we talk. Did you also notice that when you talk, the kids aren't always listening to you? But anyways, we were walking down the street, and I was in such a rush, and the bus didn't come. You know, those schedules there. You guys get the point? And you're sitting there wondering, what's she trying to tell me? So the male inclination is to say, and your point is, but you got to be nice. First of all, after about 15 times that your wife talks to you and you sort of get the hint that female modes of conversation are different than male modes of conversation, you will learn to shut off. She starts talking, you're still reading what's going on online. If it's on the phone, then for sure. I saw a guy once, his wife was talking, and his friend comes over to him, and he goes, really? And he puts down the phone. And his wife is talking away, and he talks to his friend. He says, just a second. After about a half a minute, he picks up the phone and says, that's amazing. Puts down the phone, and his wife is going on. And he's having another conversation with his friend. So it sounds funny. I was single when I saw this. I was shocked. You know, you see these in comedies.
But
at some point, you know, he kept playing this game. Now, it sounds funny to us, but when you'll have a real conversation and you'll be married for a little bit, you'll suddenly understand the guy. It'll make sense to you. And there's a challenge because we speak very differently, men and women. We'll expand on this. We got about 5 minutes. Okay. The first thing we have to know is that female conversation is not goal-oriented. The goal is to talk. Male conversation is goal-oriented. I'm talking because I want to say something to you and I want to hear what you have to say and I want to get my point across. Female conversation, the conversation itself, is a mode of connection. We connect through talk. So when women talk, their point is not the point. Their point is to talk. Their point is, through talking, we connect. And so let's talk. It doesn't matter what we talk about. It matters that we talk. Sometimes she wants to get a certain point across. Sometimes not. And so when you're rushing to leave the house, she's going to say, just a second. And you'll say, what? You have to run to catch that bus. And you'll see she's not sure what. Because the point is not what. The point is, let's have a little bit more connection before you go. Now, once you understand that her mode of conversation is not about a goal, but rather let's connect through speech, then you could guide the conversation. She doesn't mind. You can guide the conversation. She doesn't mind. We feel it's disrespectful because this is what happens when we come home and we want to share something with our spouse. You say, something amazing happened today. And she goes, really? Is it like yesterday? And you go, no. And she goes, let me guess. Your mother finally called and said we're invited for Shabbos. And you go, no. And she goes, well, let me tell you what. You're standing there. Let you tell me. I was about to tell you. And 10 minutes into the conversation, you give up. Because she's hijacked the conversation. You try for about 5 minutes to share something with her. After about 5 minutes, you say, never mind. Then after about 10 minutes, she goes, didn't you want to tell me something? And you go, never mind.
You're already exhausted.
You're exhausted. Sure, you're exhausted. Because the way we view conversation is, if you're interested in what I'm saying, then you're not going to take the conversation in a different direction. But that's not how they work. And by the same token, they don't mean bad when they take the conversation away from what we want to share with them. But we feel stupid trying to keep coming and bring it back. What am I, a child? So I don't have to tell you, so I won't tell you. Oh, we don't verbalize it that way, but that's what we feel like, and that's wrong. Because she didn't mean to take the conversation away from us. That's her way of talking. So women, firstly, are active participants in a conversation. Men are passive. So when a woman and a man are talking, there's silence on the male end and there's constant chatter on the female end. Now, it doesn't matter if he tried to say something or she tried to say something. So let's take a conversation. Your wife comes in and says, I want to tell you something amazing. You sit there in dead silence watching. She says, something amazing happened today. You sit there in dead silence watching. She says, you won't believe what happened. You sit there in dead silence watching. And you're waiting. What's the punchline? What's she about to tell me? She's not sure what she's about to tell you, but she wants your attention. So you give it to her. And about 10 seconds into the conversation, you come to a conclusion, there is no point. And at that point, you start doing other things as she's talking. I'm listening, honey, because if all you want to do is talk, I'm listening. Well, you need me to look at you while you're talking? Now imagine a phone conversation. You're on the phone, and about 5 seconds into the conversation, she says, are you alive? You say, yes, I'm listening to every word. You're in dire suspense trying to figure out what she's trying to tell you. But she's talking, and after about 15 more seconds, she goes, why don't you make any sounds of life? You say, what do you want me to do? You want me to grunt? I'm listening. She says, why can't you say anything? You say, because I'm listening. So this is a very deep source of frustration for women. We listen silently. You want to be a good husband? Repeat after her every 20 seconds. She said, so you said that. Really be an active listener. Now the flip side, you come to talk. She listens, but she's listening the way women listen. Really? When did that happen? Why did that happen? But that's not what you were trying to tell her. And did that guy next to you also annoy you today as the boss was giving you that raise? No, I'm not talking about the guy sitting next to me. So what does a woman say? Why is it that whenever you talk, you want to lecture? You want me to sit there in silence, listening. You're talking, I have to sit quietly listening. Well, it's not that you want a lecture. It's that when men listen, we're silent. And when women listen, they talk. So now put them together in a conversation and it just doesn't work. Unless you're aware of this. So she wants you to be an active listener. Uh-huh. Really? Yeah? Every 2-3 seconds she wants to hear that you're listening. But she also doesn't care if you hijack the conversation. Because that's part of active listening. And after about 15 minutes, she'll bring it back to where she wanted to go, if she wanted to go anywhere to begin with. It could be all she wanted was to connect, to converse. And when we talk, we don't have to get so annoyed. They're being active listeners. So you start on one topic, and they take it off to 3 other topics. And you can say, honey, let's pause just a second. I wanted to tell you something. And she'll say in a second, and she'll take it her own route. Now, if you can bring your wife to listen to this class, or you can explain to her, look, we speak differently. So then you could also explain to her, sometimes I come home and I want to share something with you. So what I need you to do is listen. Listen as in not talk. Can you do that? She will say, no. Okay, but if we understand one another, then you can try to work with one another. When people don't work with one another, you have the following results. Number one, the woman will be super frustrated and say, you tell your mother, you tell your friends, you don't tell me. I have to listen into your conversations with other people in order to find out what's going on in your life. Aren't I important in your life? And you'll say, I tried. And she'll say, no, why didn't you tell me? And you'll say, because you took the conversation in every direction. If you're so smart to figure it out. Usually as it's happening, you don't realize what's happening. What might also happen is that you say, you know, you're never interested in what's going on in my life. I want to share it with you, and you're not interested. And she says, what do you mean? I'm listening intently. You're listening? You took the conversation in your own directions. No, she didn't. She listened the way women listen. Listen to female conversations, and you'll see. This is their mode of communicatia. That's how they talk. So, coming back to us. When we have conversation, as we said, very often, the woman, in her mode of conversation, when listened to by a man, she frustrates him. And so we have to remind ourselves of Veshoteva Tzamat Ivrehem. One of the most important and most overlooked, I should say really the most important and most overlooked component of marriage is speech. Conversation. I don't think there's anything that comes close to it. And that's why we will constantly revisit this point. This is the greatest source of frustration for couples, and it is the greatest source of building if you can figure it out. It is the number one key. There's very little about what we do that will affect our marriage as much as what we say. What we say is the key point. That's the connector. And when today we started seeing how different we are. We're on different planets when it comes to our modes of conversation. So we will explore this more as we continue. Number one, we have to learn to show them that respect. I'm interested in what you say. And to really be focused and interested. I'll give you one quick example. A new guy walks into yeshiva. What's his name? Most people don't catch it. Me included. A guy tells us his name. We lost it. Why? Because how interested were we in catching it the first time they said it? Bill Clinton could remember a name years later. He was interested. He knows it's the key to his success. When he hears your name, he's focused and he's putting a mental marker. How will I remember that's his name? Because it's important to him. When our wives speak, we have to work on ourselves. It should be important to us. Coming back to the Mishnah, when the Torah speaks, we have to work on ourselves also that we should be thirsting. It should be important to us.